This is a special presentation of KNKX News. Tonight, KNKX connects to the Skagit Valley. Good evening, I'm Ed Ronco. For the rest of this hour, we'll bring you stories and interviews from around Skagit County, and we're going to begin tonight with what becomes immediately apparent when you arrive in the Skagit. The trees back away from the highway. The mountains seem just a little farther away, too. And all around you are wide expanses of open farmland. Agriculture is not just an industry here. It is an identity. Some of the farmers who work this land sell mass quantities of produce to big customers. Others operate small farms that supply local stores and restaurants. We sent KNKX producer Jeffrey Reddick to one of those smaller farms where he learned how farmers have banded together to get their product to market.
I visited Bow Hill Blueberries on a Tuesday morning earlier this winter. The surrounding fields were quiet. It's pruning season for the blueberry bushes, but that doesn't mean downtime for Harley Soltis and his staff. They work 6 days a week, year-round, and Tuesday is juicing day. That's the sound of 180 pounds of thawed blueberries gently squishing against the slotted sides of a big metal cylinder.
And by freezing all the fruit first, it kind of ruptures the cell structure and helps release the juice the way we do it.
Pure, unadulterated blueberry juice runs down the outside of the cylinder and into a collection bucket. Then the juice goes into bottles. 16 ounces is 547 blueberries. They had an intern count. Soltis says most of the berries on his five-acre farm are frozen right after they're picked in the summer. That allows them to get turned into something more than just a blueberry. He calls it value-added.
It's what a dairy does when they make cheese.
Bow Hill grows four different heirloom varieties, and Soltis says they had to figure out a product for each one.
We did this pickled blueberry, which has been just immensely popular all over the country, because we have a very small fruit here. One of them, the varieties, is called Arubel, and it's the original highbush wild blueberry. So it's a wild type, and it's very small and stays very crisp, and it works really well in a jar, and it worked really good. We tried some modern fruit, and it didn't work, turned mushy, and we just tried different fruit with different products, created a marinade, created a salad dressing. We worked with Lopez Island Creamery to do an ice cream flavor and found what each fruit wanted to be, what it best worked at.
They also make blueberry jam and blueberry powder for smoothies from the empty dried skins left over after the juicing. All of those products, from the pickled blueberries to the ice cream, would appear in aisles all over a grocery store. And that's the point. Bow Hill is one of the founding farms of the Puget Sound Food Hub, a kind of online farmer's market. The hub's first aggregation site was at Bow Hill, but it quickly outgrew that location. A truck idles outside the food hub's 8,000-square-foot warehouse. The driver's here to pick up food for a delivery. David Bauermeister says that's the hardest job at the hub.
We have three drivers that brave I-5 south and go to Seattle, and and they hope the traffic's kind to them every day they have to go down there.
Right. Forget about the difficulties of growing and the weather and the season. It's really the interstate that's the hard work.
It's the I-5 is the biggest challenge, right?
Bauermeister is the food hub's general manager. He says it began about 5 years ago as an ad hoc partnership. In 2016, it became a farmer-owned cooperative, and they now have 60 members. That includes Bauermeister. He's also a farmer. He says the business model is basic. Sell good food at a price that will keep farmers in business. And unlike other distributors, the food hub preserves the chain of custody, so to speak. If you want a blueberry from Bow Hill, that's what you get.
Every customer knows where their product came from, knows the farmer that grew it, and can look on our website and see the values that that farmer uses in growing their product, whether it's certified organic or organic methods, which most of our farmers do.
About those customers, the food hub doesn't sell to individual people. Their customers are grocery stores, hospitals, daycare centers, and restaurants, like Seattle's Portage Bay Cafe.
We really want to be the leaders and set the benchmark on how these farms should be showcased.
Dave Miller is Portage Bay's corporate chef. He oversees the chefs at all four locations. He says he wants them to act as advocates for farmers.
I think it's kind of an inner competition between the chefs and making sure that, you know, since they have that connection with the farmer directly, that they want to make that farmer proud. You know, we have a lot of our farmers actually come into our restaurants and eat, and I really want the feedback.
Miller says the travel goes the other way, too. He takes cooks and waitstaff on farm tours, renting a passenger van to drive around the Skagit Valley so they can see the places the food comes from. And when it hits the plate, customers can taste the freshness.
You know, we don't have to worry about something that sits on a loading dock or sits in a truck for a couple days before it gets here and then it gets delivered to us. I mean, these guys are, you know, it hits our doors probably 24, 48 hours from when it's pulled out of the ground. I mean, wow. It's truly amazing.
The Food Hub wants to keep growing. In 2018, their sales were more than $2 million, and they're planning for a 50% increase this year. They'd like to expand into more of the 12 counties of the Puget Sound region. Right now, most of the inventory comes from Whatcom and Skagit counties. But they don't want to become a supermarket to the world. And that brings us back to Bow Hill. Harley Soltis says they're producing at capacity now, but they're not going to add to their 5 acres. Doing that would not be true to the legacy of the land. For 65 years, Bow Hill was the Anderson Blueberry Farm. The Anderson family planted the bushes, opened their fields to U-Pick customers, and hired local kids to pick the rest. Their farm was part of the community. And when Soltis and his family bought it, they turned to that community for help.
Like when we decided to take this organic, we got the two largest organic blueberry farms at the time, which was the Sukuma and Cascadian. The farm manager, the organic manager there, stepped forward and like said, we'll give you all the help you need. They loaned equipment. They gave us leftover organic chemistry. You know, it's like, it was amazing amount of help. So we help anybody else who's trying to do the same stuff. Like our kitchens, we show everybody what we're doing all the time. We don't keep anything secret. So we try and do for people who are now newer than us, do all the things that everybody did for us when we started.
The Food Hub helps foster that generational cooperation, creating a framework that allows older established farmers to reach out to the younger up-and-comers. Soltis says that's the growth plan, both for his farm and for the Food Hub, to make something that lasts far into the future.
Producer Jeffrey Reddick there. The Skagit Valley needs new farmers. The number of farms is decreasing here. And statewide, some 70% of farmers are expected to retire in the next 20 years or so. But becoming a farmer can be a huge undertaking. One way people learn is through a nonprofit group called Viva Farms. They have locations in Skagit and King counties. Right now, we're standing on a 45-acre property along State Route 20, just west of Burlington. There's a chicken coop near the entrance. And soon, there will be pigs.
So they'll show up in the spring, and they're bitty.
Yeah.
They're cute.
Michael Fraser is Viva's executive director.
We provide training, bilingual training, in holistic, organic agriculture, in the land, infrastructure, equipment, capital, and markets for farms to get started.
Some people inherit family farms, hundreds or thousands of acres built up over generations. It is a much different story if you're just beginning.
If you wanted to start a farm business and at any scale and you needed to buy the land, the tractor, build a washback station, put in an irrigation system, get some sort of truck to take it to market or find your markets, it's almost an impossible climb. But with those resources that we offer, it lowers the barriers for folks to get into the farming business. And in the case where they decide they don't want to farm, they haven't put their whole life savings into something that's failed.
So Viva takes people through a two-part process. There's a 9-month practicum where you can work a season on a farm, and if that is successfully completed, you can go on to Viva's incubator program, using some of the 45 acres here to start farming crops or livestock.
The practicum is basically, you know, I want to be a farmer. The incubator is I'm going to be a farmer.
Well, I grew up in a small town in Mexico. My father grows coffee, mainly bananas and avocados.
Mauricio Soto used the Viva program to incubate his business, Arado Farms. He came to the U.S. in 1990 and spent about 10 years in California picking berries.
In the late 90s, I came up to this state, the Washington state, to pick apples.
In eastern Washington. And then he and some friends took a trip to the coast just to enjoy the ocean, buy some oysters. And they saw the Skagit Valley. He moved here. He got a job driving a potato truck. And then an ad for Viva Farms caught his eye.
I saw those flyers on the stores that come and farm and learn. And there is, you know, land in equipment that you can borrow or, you know, lease. Mm-hmm. Well, why not?
That was 6 years ago. Now his business, Arado Farms, grows strawberries and raspberries. How's it going?
Now, good.
Yeah.
Now, good. But in the beginning, really hard. Berries is, especially raspberries, you plant that year, you do all the investment. Next year, you might get some money.
But raspberries are fickle. A bad year here, a frost there. It took Soto about 3 years to get a good crop. Before he entered Viva's program, Soto managed some large berry farms. This, he says, is better.
You know, improve every year. And not only buying equipment, and not only the leasing or renting or buying more land, but, you know, it's an education you get through the life.
An education you get through life. Since its first season farming in 2010, Viva has educated more than 700 small farmers, including more than 150 Spanish speakers. It's currently incubating about two dozen independent farms. And Fraser, the group's executive director, says the program is growing farms, farmers, and community.
When you're farming elbow to elbow, no fences between the different property with folks from all kinds of different backgrounds from all over the world, you just naturally learn more about each other. And I think in that process of learning more, you find a lot more respect for each other, and a lot of barriers and stereotypes that might otherwise be in place for a lifetime can really fall apart and bring the community together.
In addition to the farm training program, Viva offers community-supported agriculture, weekly boxes delivered throughout Skagit County and Seattle, and they have a farm-to-school program to supply school cafeterias and educational outreach in 7 Skagit County districts. You're listening to KNKX Connects, an ongoing reporting project bringing us stories from across Western Washington. I'm Ed Ronco. Tonight, we're sharing stories from the Skagit Valley. Mount Vernon is the Skagit County seat. With 35,000 people, it is also the county's largest city. There's a lot going on. Downtown that's rebounding from the recession of the late 2000s, art walks, pop-up business spaces. I went for a walk with Mount Vernon Mayor Jill Boudreau, and I asked her to name the biggest issue faced by her community.
I think poverty right now, and that, like, you know, it's easy to maybe say homelessness because I think a lot of cities are dealing with that, but ultimately it's poverty. They want to know that the farm workers, you know, have an opportunity and their children do. They want to know that the school system is doing everything they can. So I would say broadly poverty.
You mentioned that a lot of people who live here commute outside the county.
Yes, almost half. Either north or south.
How do you feel about that?
That's part of that long-term vision of before I leave office, I hope we can work, not just the city of Mount Vernon, as a county to have those industries and those jobs here.
And Skagit County is working to retain and attract industries and jobs, especially in manufacturing, which might surprise some people who know this area largely for its wide expanses of farmland or the Skagit Valley Tulip Festival every April.
Well, I think that's a common perception. I think there are even some people in Skagit County who might think first of agriculture and tulips when they think about us.
That voice was John Sternlicht, CEO of the Economic Development Alliance of Skagit County. He says agriculture is incredibly important here, but that the biggest contributor to this county's economy, at least in terms of money, is what's called advanced manufacturing.
I think it's anywhere that requires skills to put things together, and those are a lot of the manufacturers we have. They build ships. They build parts for airplanes.
So to learn more, I went to two businesses that do just that, starting in Anacortes.
Wow.
I am standing underneath the MV Coho. It's a ferry that takes passengers and vehicles between Port Angeles and Victoria, BC. It's in dry dock for annual maintenance at Dakota Creek Industries. It weighs 5,135 tons. It's 72 feet across, it's slightly longer than a football field, and it is both beautiful and terrifying as it looms over my head, propped up on enormous blocks made of concrete and wood.
This boat's so well maintained, it looks really good underneath, the paint does.
Mike Nelson is the company's owner. Dakota Creek Industries has been in his family since it was founded in 1975. They do a variety of work here. Just down the docks from where we're standing, they're putting the finishing touches on an enormous factory trawler fishing vessel.
Bringing wire and stuff on board now. fishing gear.
They have made research ships and tugboats, and right now, in what looks like an airplane hangar, they are welding and hammering on two aluminum ferries that will eventually carry passengers around San Francisco Bay. This is precise work.
The welding techniques are pretty advanced, and then the accuracy level has to be very good as everything changes as you weld it.
Skagit County, and this northern edge of Anacortes specifically, offers the geography and the workforce Nelson says his company needs. They moved here from Blaine in 1977. Only slightly newer is VT Vallant, about a 20-minute drive away. And to understand what this company does, we have to put ourselves inside a passenger jet for a moment or two.
As soon as everyone's seated, we'll be able to close the door and push back.
So it's just before a flight, and I want you to picture what usually happens while the passengers are boarding.
So where's your seat, Dean?
People are dragging their luggage down the aisle. They're shoving it into overhead bins. They are chucking their bags and their coats under the seats. Maybe they're using their feet to cram everything in. The belt buckles are hitting the armrests. And then once the flight starts and people get settled, they're resting their heads on the sidewall of the cabin. They might spill some liquid on the seats.
You guys know that you're sitting in an exit row?
The point is that airplane interiors take a beating. And every so often, airlines pull everything out of the cabin, and they send it here to a 150,000 square foot building on the outskirts of Burlington. VT Vallant repairs commercial airline interiors, overhead bins, oxygen masks, reading lights, the flight attendant call buttons, everything, the seats, the walls, the window shades. Most of their work ends up on the flights that you or I might take, but they do custom work, too, including on planes for the NBA.
That's right. We've done oversized lavatories to fit 7'5" guys in there.
That's Vice President and General Manager Tom Thompson. This company has a $6 million backlog, and that's going to keep this team busy for the next 2 years.
Customers are demanding more than we can put out right now, so which is a wonderful problem to have. But we were, at the beginning of the year last year, we were at about 75 people. Right now, we're at about 104. And our expectation is to be somewhere between around 130 to 145 by the end of this year.
Thompson says the work here requires craftsmanship and artistry. Larry Morris is sitting at a work table, wiring a panel for overhead reading lights. He's worked here nearly a decade and is 79 years old.
Well, my previous employer had to shut down their business. And I was a supervisor on a crew there, and I was going to retire. And my wife says, get out of the house. So I came back to work.
Morris also trains new employees. With him today is Felicissima Cassinger. It is her first day of work. She's returning to the workforce, in fact, after recovering from a surgery. She used to work for FEMA, which involved a lot of travel that she did not like doing. And she says this is interesting.
It fascinated me because I always wanted to be an engineer. I used to work for GE in the 70s. And I work with technicians, but...
But she never really pursued the field. Now she says she can, here. Thompson, the general manager, pays attention to the local talent pool, but he also frets over the cost of living as he watches people priced out of King County.
If people want to work here, but they can't afford to live here, and that's what's happening in King County, people have to move. And so it's a sad reality, but how do we make sure that we continue to grow an economy properly, but also keep it affordable for people to want to live in the county?
We're right in the middle of 6.5 million people.
Again, John Sternlicht with the Economic Development Alliance of Skagit County.
And it's important to us to keep the natural beauty and the agricultural lands intact.
But it's hard not to worry about a squeeze as people leave expensive urban centers for more rural places. So far, though, Sternlicht says what's happening here is more measured than the unfettered boom Seattle seems to be experiencing.
I don't know, I might say a boomlet rather than an entire boom. But we have experienced in migration, but what we also have is a good chunk of our population that leaves Skagit County every day to go work outside of the county.
Sternlicht thinks the next decade will bring small to medium manufacturers into Skagit County. Not a drastic change, he says, but he also acknowledges that nothing stays the same. For example, the refineries in Anacortes. They've been here a while, and they are a huge and important part of the local economy.
We all recognize on some level that reliance on fossil fuels will be decreasing over the next decades, and we need to make sure that the people who work here and live here have those good family wage jobs that'll be existing in the future.
So Sternlich says it's a balancing act, retaining the business that exists now, recognizing some of it might change or diminish in the decades to come, and attracting new companies that want to make their home in Skagit County. One of the people we met in Skagit County was Dr. B'nai Shah. He's an oncologist at Peace Health, but he's also the face of the B'nai Tara Foundation.
So what we do is try to improve access to healthcare, access to cancer care in the United States and in low-income countries such as Nepal and India. So for example, in India, we have a partnership with the government of India, and we are working on establishing 51 hospice and palliative care programs in Madhya Pradesh, which is a state of 73 million people there.
73 million people.
That is correct.
51
centers. Right, right, right. So, you know, until 2 years ago, they had zero centers.
And then in Nepal, you've just opened, relatively recently, a bone marrow transplant center.
That is correct. So bone marrow transplant center was established approximately 3 years ago, and it was a partnership between our foundation as well as a government hospital in Nepal and University of Illinois at Chicago.
Why that particular thing? Why bone marrow transplants?
So bone marrow transplant is the only treatment modality for some of the blood cancers and blood diseases.
So leukemia, things like that?
That is correct. Leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma, aplastic anemia, and all that. So in a country of 30 million people, they did not have any bone marrow transplant center prior to that.
What would happen before this center opened to people who had lymphoma or leukemia or multiple myeloma?
It depends on it depended on who you were. If you were wealthy, you'd go to India or some other country to get bone marrow transplant. And if you are not wealthy, you die.
We're sitting in your office, and the only thing on the wall is this picture of Mother Teresa. She was an influence for you, I'm guessing?
She is my hero. So when I was growing up in high school, I read maybe 200 books or so about religion, philosophy, biographies, all kinds of books. The one book that stood out was Biography of Mother Teresa, and the kind of impact she had on humanity was tremendous. Essentially, whatever I'm doing is a kind of moral obligation on my part, as to, you know, because I feel more privileged than many other people around me. Even a small contribution can have dramatic impact on the lives of individuals around me.
I had a long conversation with Dr. Shah about his work in Nepal and India, and also heard his thoughts on healthcare in the U.S. and what we can learn from the rest of the world. You can hear the extended interview on our website, knkx.org. So we've heard about manufacturing and healthcare, and now it's time for a very particular kind of research. Washington State University operates a lab in Burlington where you can eat the experiments. It is called the Bread Lab, and it looks for ways to improve upon wheat. KNKX producer Jeffrey Reddick paid a visit with our food commentator, Nancy Leeson, and when he got back, we sat down in a studio to listen to what happened.
She was super excited about this from the beginning. And so, of course, when I got there, she was already there.
She was that eager.
And when I showed up, she was eating.
Oh, my God.
It was a croissant.
I was surprised at how much I like it because I happen to have a little bit of a bias against whole wheat as opposed to mixing other types of flour with whole wheat.
If you want to mix a little whole wheat in with your white, that's fine as sort of a gateway to whole wheat.
So that guy is Stephen Jones. Mm-hmm. He's the one who created the Bread Lab in the first place. Bread Lab is part of Washington State University.
Okay.
So Stephen Jones is a geneticist, and he's a wheat breeder.
A wheat breeder, yeah.
Before we get there, I want to make the point that Nancy was raised upright, and and she showed up with a gift.
I brought you a loaf of bread, and I'm very curious for you to break into it, cut into it, and have a taste and tell me what you think of it.
It's absolutely gorgeous. So the exterior, the crust is beautiful. We just sort of filleted it open like that, and the crumb is gorgeous and moist. It's beautiful.
I'd be curious to know if you can taste what type of flours I've used.
So is it like an emmer or an einkorn and bread wheat?
Half triticale and half bread flour. So the triticale is a hybrid of wheat and rye.
You know, after the fact, we can sort of pick that up, but that's a tough one to pick up. So congratulations, you stumped us.
Way to go.
That was fun.
That's great. Now, Nancy has brought in bread here to KNKX before. It is outstanding. And that was fun to listen to, but it doesn't sound like you went up there to play, you know, stump the chef.
Right.
Okay.
When we were there, we watched them getting all these little tiny loaves of testing ready for the oven. The test baker is Julia Burstein.
We have like over 100 samples of wheat from Montana that we're testing, and they're all pretty similar, but they could be grown in different places or they could be different varieties. And we treated them this exact same way when we mixed and folded and shaped. And now we are just going to score them and bake them.
So, Julia, I bought myself a lahm. And what a lahm is, can you explain what it is?
It's a very thin blade that you use to score or make a cut in the top of a loaf of bread.
Right. And it looks just like, you know, your grandfather's razor blade.
Yeah.
In your case, just a stick.
Yeah.
And explain, more importantly, why somebody would use one.
So when you make a score mark, you're letting a specific part of the bread steam, and you're opening up sort of the inside to the surface, and that creates a canvas for different colors to emerge when you bake it.
I have to ask, is this the best-smelling room you've ever been in your life?
You don't have to know the address of this place. Like if you are sort of in the general area.
Like in the cartoons when like the pie on the windowsill and the character would just kind of float through the air.
Yes.
Okay.
Back to the idea of where they start is in the ground and the wheat. There's one guy who's in charge of that part.
Okay.
Tell me who you are and what you do here.
My name's Steve Lyon, and they really don't know what to call me. I say I do everything in the dirt. See what
you mean? You're the guy with a pitchfork?
I'm the farmer. What's different that we're doing here than when we're in Eastern Washington, and it sounds so dumb, but we actually taste the bread before we release a variety. It's so fun because I have a lot of heritage wheats, really old varieties. 2 years ago, I brought one into Julia to test bake. It's an old French line. And she hollered at me and said, come smell this. It had a citrusy smell to it. She said it was lemon. I could tell it was citrus.
You don't even need to put orange marmalade on your toast.
No.
You just have the toast.
It's incredible.
Citrusy wheat.
Right. And so like,
wow.
It just really underscored to me the experimentation that they get to do there.
Mm-hmm.
So far, everything that I've shared with you has happened in this one main room where they do a lot of the test baking. There's a mill room right next to that. And then the room next to that is where we met Nels Brisbane.
I'm the culinary director here at the Bread Lab, and I'm focusing on non-bread-based applications of grains.
Okay, wait. What?
Right. Non-bread-based applications of grains.
All right.
We should just let him explain.
Here we have poblano peppers. They are filled with a miso that has been made from local barley and local chickpeas. Then I piped it inside of the poblano peppers, and then they get roasted and then hung to air dry. They air dry for about 2 months, but can be ready as soon as 1 month.
Ready for what?
They actually eat almost like a charcuterie.
No kidding. So
yeah.
Do you then take the outside poblano off and eat the inside? Or are you supposed to eat the poblano too?
Would you like to experience it? And then you,
would I?
So you can kind of see.
Okay, so it is the middle. You're not. You wouldn't necessarily be eating this
you,
part.
Yeah, you can.
Oh my. Wow. That is beyond incredible.
Yeah.
Mm. So I'm tasting a lot of deep flavor that is very similar to what I would think of if I took a little bit of miso on a spoon.
Mm-hmm. This is a spice version.
Oh, man. So there's a lot of stuff going on there because you get those really peppery notes. This is delicious. You're kidding me. This is made out of just grains grown locally here in Skagit?
Other than black pepper and kosher salt, this is 100% Skagit.
And he said it's all from the Skagit Valley.
Right. And so that's...
Except for the salt and pepper, but you know.
Right. what I realized being there is that the bread lab and the magic skagit, as they say there, it's become like this touchstone for people who are interested in doing this kind of thing in their own communities.
Wheat from your lab has been venerated now all over our country as well as internationally, and people come here to this bread lab from all over the world.
We're part of a system that has been needed, right? So people want their regional grain system back. They want something back that we had lost, and it's not going backwards. I think it's a really important point. It's just capturing something that we should not have lost. A big part of what we do, I mean, we bake a lot of bread and cookies, but we're wheat breeders first, and we work with the farmers first. So we help the farmers become more economically stable in this environment.
And people think of the Skagit as a place to come see tulips, but people like me see it, and you, I'm sure, see it as a place where we're preserving farmland and keeping this little bit of beautiful geography for time immemorial, we hope.
Does the public have access to this? I mean, is this just a thing that's reporting results to farmers and commercial bakeries, or are they serving anybody who has a question about their bread that they're baking?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the same day we were there, they also had this group from LeConnor High School. Some of them already knew about the bread lab, either because their parents are farmers and they've, you know, grown up on a farm, or because their parents have gone to cooking school.
Oh.
There's a King Arthur sponsored cooking school that's attached to the bread lab.
King Arthur's the popular brand of baking supplies, flour especially.
Right. And they've got two cooking schools in the country. One of them is in Skagit County at the bread lab. I feel really lucky that I got to go there with Nancy and kind of watch her just be incredibly excited and fascinated with all the stuff that they're doing.
Well, Jeffrey Reddick, thank you for taking us to the Bread Lab in Skagit County.
Absolutely, Ed. It was a lot of fun.
You're listening to KNKX Connects. I'm Ed Bronco. Our ongoing reporting project has taken us to communities across Western Washington. This evening, we're reporting from the Skagit Valley. Right now, we want to introduce you to Matt Mallion. He's a chaplain and a writer, and he spends nearly every Wednesday afternoon sitting in a room with kids wearing orange jumpsuits. They meet in the Skagit County Juvenile Detention Center. They read poems and song lyrics together, and then they write together. The program is called Underground Writing. Mallion started it in 2015. He was inspired by other programs around the country, like Inside Out Writers in Los Angeles, and he was motivated by a great personal trauma.
The death of my father and writing a series of stories about our family. And I did that over the course of a year after his death, and what I found at the end was that I had really worked through all the trauma.
Mallion thought if writing helped lead him out of despair, maybe it could do the same for other people. Now, 3.5 years after it started, Underground Writing has grown. They have a podcast and a new book and workshops in 5 Skagit County locations. The writers who volunteer their time lead workshops with teenagers at juvenile detention, a club for migrant students, and an overnight shelter. Sometimes the instructors only see a student once. Sometimes they work together for years. Either way, Mallion told KNKX producer Jeffrey Reddick that he tries to introduce students to authors who are relevant to their lives, like Jimmy Santiago Baca, an award-winning poet who learned to read in prison.
That's really important for those students to see that, oh, Jimmy Santiago Baca was in juvenile detention, and then he went on to prison as an adult, and that's where he discovered his love of reading and writing, and now he's a well-established author, and he often will go back into juvenile detention and teach, you know, kind of like we're doing here. I brought the first couple pages of Dante's Inferno into juvenile detention. It was great. The poet narrator is talking about, like, he's come to a place in his life, feels totally trapped and in a dark wood, and he's thinking about what's happened before and what's happening next, and he's really kind of tense about this. And all the kids were like, yeah, they're right there. That's where they are.
It can be kind of a scary thing to share something that you've written with even just one other person, let alone a larger group. How do you create a feeling of trust where they're able to share?
I think it has to be an embodied awareness that you're there to connect and that you're there to form a relationship with the student, even if it's only for one workshop. Our students are people who have encountered great pain or struggle or trauma, and people that have gone through that are often extremely sensitive, and they can see through a lot of masks or falsity. I think our program and our teaching writers really go to great lengths to show compassion and care, and I think the students can feel that right off.
How has this work revealed the community to you in a way that you wouldn't have seen without it?
I guess I'm always wondering what people's stories are in a different way than I used to, because our students, in part, we know their story. And I think it causes me to see people differently, to be less quick to judge. I've been told so many stories by our students, stuff that I just didn't actually want to hear. I mean, I did because I wanted to care for the person, but man, some of it's heavy. And then some of it's just crazy. Crazy in the sense of funny or lighthearted, or I can think of one student who wrote, and he's got a piece in the book, and he mentions the nickname that his mom used to call him, and it's Deedle Bug, and I had never heard that. It's just so funny, and it's so authentic and specific and to that person. It's just those moments are great too. We have we laugh a lot with the students, even students going through great pain and awaiting trial, and they're going to have some years coming down on them. And we get to have moments of laughter and real joy.
Could I ask you to read from the book?
The two most common prompts that we've used that appear in our book are the Dear America prompt. The first time I used that prompt was the day after the 2016 election. The other prompt we've used a lot comes from the interaction between Walt Whitman and Langston Hughes, where Walt Whitman wrote Leaves of Grass, and inside that are pieces that talk about, I am America, and this is America, and I see America, and this is what I see, and he lists everything. When Langston Hughes came along in the 1920s and read that poem and didn't see himself in the poem, then he responds with a poem called I Too. So we often will get students to write an I Too poem where they're responding to where are you not represented in either of these visions of America? What's your story? So this comes from one of those prompts. It's called I Sing America in Hospital Beds. I Too Sing America in Hospital Beds. Wires stuck to my skull with heavy glue. In an office checking yes to disability, clarifying, I have epilepsy, but they aren't listening after that. The I have, the yes. I too sing America. In my nightmares of fire and threats, the news eagerly shares. In school, working ahead because if the medicine fails, I can't take back the time. I, too, sing America. They hear epilepsy and pretend they can't hear me.
When people read the book, is there something that you hope they take away from that?
I'd love for it to be a unit of both instruction / inspiration, and that people, particularly if they're from outside here where there is nothing in their community like this, that it will inspire them to maybe do something like this, a storytelling night, regularly, or a writing program like this, or whatever. In our own community, I hope that people read the book and read the writings in a way that, in the best way possible, causes their hearts to break. I really do. This idea of when our hearts are broken, that's when space is created for other things to get in. If it's closed and whole and everything is fine, things can't get in our heart that way.
Matt Mallion is the executive director of Underground Writing. You can hear an extended version of this interview at knkx.org. That is also where you will find links to sign up for the Underground Writing podcast or to order the book titled What No One Ever Tells You. The book launch party is February 21st at 6 p.m. inside the Mount Vernon City Library. The mountains loom large here in the Skagit River Valley. Visitors come from all over the world to spend time exploring the massive peaks of the North Cascades. But few people get the perspective on them enjoyed by our next set of guests. John Riedel is a geologist with the U.S. National Park Service. He has been documenting the response of Washington's glaciers to climate change. And John Scurlock is a photographer and a pilot who works with scientists like Riedel. Scurlock has just finished capturing aerial images of all the glaciers in the lower 48. KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe met up with them in Cedro Woolley to learn more about their work. Scurlock, the photographer, says collaborating with scientists was not his main objective when he started 17 years ago.
I'm fortunate that what I've done combines my three obsessions, namely flying, photography, and mountainous terrain. And I built my airplane from a kit. Yeah, it sounds crazy, but it's really not crazy, trust me. And because I live right next to Mount Baker, I immediately started flying around Mount Baker. And that put me rather quickly into touch with scientists.
So John Riedel, you monitor glaciers at 8 sites all around Washington State. You're taking measurements up to 3 times a year. And you're seeing the effects of climate change.
With our glacier monitoring program, which I started in 1993, this is focused at the 3 national parks in Washington, we monitor glaciers seasonally for changes in winter accumulation and summer melt, and then we're able to add or subtract the value from year to year to get a really clear trend in the change in volume of these glaciers. We also track the entire population of glaciers in the national parks using aerial photography, which is where John Scurlock has been very helpful. What we're seeing with the glaciers is a pretty pronounced decrease in their volume that's being driven mainly by warmer and longer summers. But with the glaciers, they're super sensitive to temperature, to air temperature, because not only does it affect how fast they melt in the summer, but it also determines whether they get rained on or snowed upon in the spring and the fall. And so the glaciers are sort of getting this double whammy where the amount of snowfall is decreasing and summer melting is increasing. So we see in North Cascades and Olympic National Park, 50, 52, 53% loss in glacier area in the last century.
So John Scurlock, how does what he's saying line up with what you've been seeing from the air?
All over the lower 48, I've seen glaciers, and I've seen no evidence of a glacier growing. There's one exception, that would be inside the crater on Mount St. Helens. But it's a special situation where no glacier existed. And then because of the eruption, it created an environment where the glacier could form.
Is one glacier really that different from another?
Oh, yeah. I've photographed glaciers all over Western North America. And when you go from south to north in general, you go from glaciers that are glaciers in name only, really, just little fragments of ice, all the way up to Alaska, where you have massive glaciers several miles wide. So there's a huge difference.
What about scientifically?
These glaciers are all unique. They have their own relationship to the mountain, to the weather, the climate. Much like rivers and, I suppose, children, each glacier is unique.
How bad is the loss of glaciers for our water supply? I read one account of a presentation you gave to regional watershed managers here in the Skagit. It said they gasped collectively when they saw pairs of images showing how extreme the recession of the glaciers is.
The Skagit River is the largest watershed draining into Puget Sound. The amount of glacial water in the Skagit in the summer is somewhere between 6 to 12%. And so that provides what we call a buffering capacity or insurance for our summer drought or for longer-term droughts for species that inhabit the Skagit River. And so really what we have in the Skagit Valley, as I often say, is a little piece of Alaska here where we have fairly extensive glaciers, a large amount of glacial meltwater that suppresses the summer river temperature and provides water even after the snow melt has long since melted away. So that stability that the glaciers impart to our aquatic ecosystems, I think, is one of the reasons certainly why all 5 native species of salmon come into the Skagit River.
For each of you, is there a favorite glacier here in Washington State?
It's tough to pick a single favorite, but if pressed to do that, I would say probably the Redoubt Glacier on Mount Redoubt. And that's a site where I did some research for my master's degree back in the mid-80s. I've been in there 20-some times.
And you, John Scarlett?
I think for me it would be either the McAllister Glacier, which is a beautiful glacier in North Cascades National Park that comes off the northwest flank of El Dorado Peak. But I'm also another glacier that I'm very fond of is a Challenger Glacier. Because I've traveled across it on foot, I've photographed it from the air many times. It just epitomizes the wild and remote nature of the North Cascades, in my opinion.
And part of what you do is capturing the same angle on a glacier as we have in historical photographs, so that these can be compared by scientists. Now, that sounds really difficult to me. What's your process? How do you get the right shot?
Well, it is very difficult. Once you're there actually taking the photograph, there are so many variables that can affect your ability to put the plane in exactly that same position. It could be windy, maybe the sun is different. I'm pretty much reduced to blanketing a certain glacier with photographs on the general assumption that one or a few of them will come out approximately right.
And he's done this several times for me. I think the first round was in the mid, like 2005 or 6, I think, and he re-photographed a number of the glaciers for me in 2016 and directly compared them to this incredible historic photo set taken by Austin Post, who was a geologist pilot, worked for the U.S. Geological Survey. And so many of our comparative images come from the late 50s, early 60s that John has done a remarkable job re-photographing. And the paired images are stunning because in many cases the glaciers have disappeared completely. We have photos from the Olympic Mountains where the glaciers are gone. And in other cases, the change is so dramatic, you see huge loose fields of rubble that used to be covered by ice 50 or 100 years ago. And I think, you know, if one picture is worth 1,000 words, two pictures combined, Scurlock and Post, is probably worth 1,000,000.
John Riedel, he's a geologist with the U.S. National Park Service. He and photographer John Scurlock spoke with KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. You can find more information about their work at knkx.org. We've just spent some time talking about nature. Let's spend just a few seconds now in nature. This time of year, tens of thousands of snow geese and trumpeter swans arrive to the fields of the Skagit Valley, pausing in their migration before they head farther north for breeding. And we will pause now to listen to a flock of trumpeter swans on Fur Island. That's it for us tonight. Thanks so much to the Mount Vernon City Library and its staff for hosting our broadcast last week. And thanks to the many, many people who shared their stories with us, as well as to all of you for listening. Our news director is Aaron Hennessy. Our director of content is Matt Martinez. Our digital content manager is Kari Plogue. Lil Kiso is our engineer with IT support from Tad Doviak. Dave Meyer ran the controls in Tacoma during the broadcast. And special thanks to Parker Blohm, Ariel Van Cleve, and Audrey Daniels-Kalis. The producer of this program is Jeffrey Reddick. If you missed any of our reporting from the Skagit Valley or from any of the other locations where we've taken our KNKX Connects project, visit us online, knkx.org/connects. That's where you can link to all of the broadcasts we've done in this series. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. I'm Ed Ronco. Have a great evening.